From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn how Wisconsin hospitals are coping with the surge of COVID-19 and what that means for patients and healthcare workers. Then we talk about the importance of learning to navigate life during this pandemic.
We are in the space where people are significantly challenged and it's affecting their ability to perform. And it's not on the radar screen of leaders that their people are going through this. And I don't believe that that's the denial. I just think they lack awareness.
Plus, the latest Listen MKE examines the importance of good mentorship.
Kids will be what they see. If you see people selling dope, then that's what you're going to do. And kids will be what they see men doing confidently. If we're very confident in our athletic ability, then, you know, we're going to have a lot of athletes. The idea is to create something where children can see men being confident.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Cases of COVID-19 are at a record high in Wisconsin. Over the past month, the state has become one of the nation's leading hotspots for new infections, and the surge isn't showing any signs of slowing. As more and more people are being sickened, hospitals are becoming overburdened with patients. And if infections don't start to level off, hospitals could run out of resources, threatening the health and safety of all Wisconsinites. Dr. Mark Kaufman is the chief medical officer at the Wisconsin Hospital Association, and he joins me now to talk about the situation here. Dr. Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is a big question, but right now, what is the current state of hospitals in Wisconsin?
Right now, hospitals across Wisconsin are very stressed because of the record number of Wisconsin citizens being infected with COVID-19, almost setting a new record every day. And ultimately, a certain percentage of those are going to require hospitalization. As we continue to set records for new cases almost every day, hospitals who are taking care of both the COVID patients and all the non-COVID patients who have significant health conditions, hospitals are finding that, especially with respect to healthcare personnel and nursing staff, they're getting stretched to the limits.
Yeah, when we say stressed, what does that look like? You just mentioned, of course, the hospital staff, the resources. What does that look like at a hospital?
Well, that means there is daily, multiple times a day, incredibly close management trying to match patient needs, both COVID and non-COVID, to hospital resources, whether it's regular beds or ICU beds or the healthcare workforce to take care of the patients. It sometimes means postponing or canceling scheduled procedures. It means shuffling staff, sometimes from outpatient areas to inpatient areas as the demand to take care of patients in the hospital increases. Sometimes transferring patients to different facilities to match hospital resources to the patient volumes and needs.
As you mentioned, a lot of this leads to shifting around resources and in some cases, canceling other procedures. So if you're someone who needs to go to the hospital for, say, a standard kind of issue, like you're going for, let's say, chemo treatments, or you're going for a surgery, what does that mean for you if these hospitals are a bit exacerbated?
Well, it may mean that your treatment or procedure will get temporarily postponed. What's happening in hospitals and what hospitals have planned for since the spring is that there's really close management. So there are typically groups of administrators and especially clinicians who look at the elective procedures that are scheduled that week or the next day. And if that hospital is particularly stressed, and they do need to temporarily postpone some procedures, they get together and they decide from a clinical perspective which procedures or surgeries are safest to temporarily postpone with respect to the patient and the need for surgery and the urgency, and which interventions, whether it's chemo or something else, really need to proceed and to allocate those non-COVID resources to those non-COVID patients who are the highest priority. So that's really active management that's going on a daily basis when hospitals are stressed in terms of resources.
Now, this is a question that might sound a little obvious, but do hospitals really fill up? Could there be a situation here in Wisconsin where the hospitals, all of them, are full?
I think it's really unlikely that we will have all, I believe, 134 hospitals in Wisconsin full. But depending upon the area and the surge in COVID and the hospital capacity, there's no doubt that many hospitals are operating at peak capacity, sometimes are not able to accept new patients in emergencies, and those patients are sent to other hospitals. And even in non-COVID times, hospitals work together to transfer patients depending upon the level of acuity of the illness of the patient. What's happening in COVID times is, and this is actually a bit of good news, not only are hospitals working together within systems, we have a lot of large integrated multi-hospital systems in Wisconsin, but hospitals across systems in the same geographic area, you know, normally who would, quote, compete in the business sense, are cooperating, collaborating, sharing data, matching resources to patients. So everybody understands that it's all hands on deck. It's about getting the care to Wisconsin citizens, and really all of healthcare, and especially hospitals, are working very, very hard together to make sure that we can meet the healthcare needs of all Wisconsin citizens, COVID issues and non-COVID issues. But hospitals truly are getting stretched to the limits. And if you look at the curves of the graphs that show the number of COVID-19 patients hospitalized, we're now over 2,000 as of yesterday and the day before. And just to give you an idea, in the spring when we were sort of new at COVID and we're all very concerned, we were in the 300 to 400 range, and now we're in the 2,000 range. So it's been a dramatic, dramatic increase.
Yeah. So the good news here is that it seems if one hospital is really stretched to its limits, it's at least more likely that you'll be able to get into another hospital here in Wisconsin. But what does that mean for a patient? If you can't go to the hospital that's closest to you, what happens next?
Typically, the clinicians at the hospital are talking to each other and discuss the clinical situation for the patient and agree that the patient would be best served in terms of his or her health outcome to be transferred, and then the transfer is arranged.
By a transfer, so would they be driving to another hospital? I don't know in parts of the state really how close hospitals are. I grew up in a more rural area, and you know, we had one hospital that was maybe about 20 minutes away, but I don't even know how far the next one was.
Yeah. So it really depends upon the clinical, how sick the patient is, but typically it would be an EMT or an ambulance transfer. But you would pick the mode of transportation that was appropriate for the illness and the severity of illness of the patient. And that goes to both COVID and non-COVID patients.
So as we're looking at the situation in hospitals, I think one of the major components is, of course, the people who work there, the nurses, the doctors. How are they doing right now?
It depends on the hospital, but everybody's very dedicated. But in terms of how the healthcare workers are doing, I think the impact has been greatest likely for the nurses, who probably spend most of their time actually in the presence of patients. And what's happened is, as the pandemic has spread throughout every community in Wisconsin, those nurses and other healthcare workers obviously live in those communities, and they are at risk of both catching COVID-19, but also being a close contact of somebody who is diagnosed with COVID-19. And when that happens, the close contact needs to quarantine for 14 days. So if you're in a rural community and it's a relatively small pool of nurses and your nursing staff starts needing to quarantine because they have been in contact in the community with someone who has COVID-19, that takes a huge toll on your nursing workforce and their ability to work at the hospital and care for patients with COVID-19, as well as with all the other non-COVID-19 healthcare issues. So that is really the pinch point right now. It's not so much the physical beds, it's having nursing staff available to take care of patients.
I know Wisconsin, especially our more rural areas, we've had an issue with nursing shortages, with doctor shortages to some extent. Is that something that we're still dealing with right now?
Certainly, COVID has made the chronic shortages in healthcare personnel worse over the last 6 months. The state and actually the hospital association have done a very good job over the last 5-7 years addressing the physician shortage. But I think the shortage that everybody's concerned about right now with respect to caring for patients in hospitals is more a nursing shortage. And one of the challenges is, one of the typical responses with the nursing shortage is to recruit nurses from other states, to use contract agencies. And the Wisconsin Department of Health Services has done a really good job of loosening restrictions and regulations and allowing nurses from neighboring states and other healthcare workers to transfer their licenses and to be able to work in Wisconsin. But the unfortunate thing is, because the pandemic has spread throughout all states, every state is scrambling and trying to use contract nurses and see if healthcare workers from other states can come work in their states. So because the pandemic is pretty much everywhere, the ability to bring in nurses from out of state, the impact of loosening regulations with respect to licensure and ability to practice, all good things, but practically they're not great solutions right now because every state is scrambling for healthcare personnel.
Of course. As we look at the state of Wisconsin right now, where we're at in this pandemic, realistically, what does the trajectory look like?
The trajectory, if you look at the number of patients hospitalized with COVID-19 or the number of new cases every day, the trajectory of those curves is terrifying. They're almost vertical. We set yet another record in Wisconsin for new cases. If we don't flatten that curve and dampen that trajectory, we will run out of hospital resources. That is the very terrifying and bad news. The good news is that we have the ability, individually and collectively, it is within our power to flatten the curve and to slow the pandemic. And we can do that, but we all need to do it. And we need to follow the public health measures that are being recommended. Wear a mask, physically distance, good personal hygiene with frequent hand washing, limit indoor private gatherings, get tested if you have symptoms, get a flu shot if you don't have contraindications. If we all do that in Wisconsin, it will work. And despite all the optimistic talk of a vaccine, and there has been some real good developments in the last week, that the vaccine is not going to help us in the next 3 months to get through this winter. For the next 3 months, we all need to triple down on the public health measures. If we all do that individually and collectively, we will slow hospitalizations, we will slow new cases, and we will flatten the curve. So the tools are there. It's in our ability to slow the pandemic. We just have to do it.
All right. Well, Dr. Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mark Kaufman is the Chief Medical Officer at the Wisconsin Hospital Association. You can find more of our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic at WUWM.com. Coming up next, Jennifer Bartolotta talks about how learning more about ourselves helps us connect with others. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The pandemic has taken a toll on every aspect of our lives. We're all experiencing a level of uncertainty that impacts our mental health, our relationships, and our work. Jennifer Bartolotta, the founder of Bartolotta & Associates, has learned to look at work and life through a trauma-informed lens. She believes we can use these difficult experiences to help us connect with other people. Bartolotta is leading an event on this topic for Women's Entrepreneurship Week here in Milwaukee. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about her work and begins by explaining why acknowledging these experiences is important.
You know, I think we're reticent, most of us, to say that we've got it rough right now or that we're in a spot that challenges us, because I think it's also safe to say, well, it's a great generalization that we're all feeling it. I also think it's safe to say that we all know somebody or many people who are far worse off than we find ourselves. But there's this concept of self-care, right? And it feels very, I think, incongruent for people to engage in something that's called self-care right now when they know so many other people who are so much worse off than they are. But here's the thing about it. It doesn't deny that fact that there are people out there that are worse off than we are shouldn't stand in the way of us feeling through what we're going through. Between everything that's happened since March and today, the amount of life and uncertainty and trauma and pain that we have all suffered collectively and individually has taken a toll on everybody. And so I like to think of it as self-preservation, right? If we deny that we are challenged right now, then we're doing not just ourselves a huge disservice, but we're doing anybody that's in our tribe or our immediate circle a disservice, because the caregiving that we might normally extend to them in whatever capacity, right? Whether you're the high wage earner of the home, or you're the stay-at-home parent who's trying to juggle a job and manage virtual learning, we're all going through it. And you can't move forward and start to address unless you acknowledge that, wow, I'm in a really painful spot right now.
I feel like stepping away from our culture of pushing things aside or, you know, just get the, quote, important things done, and how self-care has had a little bit of a bad connotation. But as you mentioned, now people are admitting, yeah, it's hard, and we're not doing so great. Do you think that this will be a tipping point in mental health, not just awareness, but a greater increase in care? Whether we start looking introspectively or people are ready to take those steps of seeking out the help of, say, a therapist or any other methods?
You know, it is my hope, and it's why I'm doing this work right now. You know, there are people out there far much worse off than I am. But in the last 18 months, I lost my husband. I had to step away from the company that we worked together to build for 18 years. That company then had to close as a result of COVID, and, you know, no fault of anybody's, but had to close. And almost 900 people that were part of my family. Have you ever worked in a restaurant?
No, I have not.
You know, when you work in a restaurant, all these people who have come from very divergent backgrounds show up. And one of our managers called us the island of the misfits. And all these people from very divergent lives show up, and then they have the ability to check themselves and their stuff at the door and come together in the most beautiful way as a family unit to take care of the public. And these are warm, loving, kind, caring, concerned, compassionate, empathetic people who have been displaced, right? And it's just not just the Bartolotta employees, it's the entire hospitality industry. And that, you know, that takes a toll. So I feel that this work is so important right now because I think we lack awareness. We don't come with a manual. You know, I start the discussion out by saying, look, if I have to distill this whole thing down into one idea, it's the manual I wish somebody would have given to me before Joe died, but let's face it, I wouldn't have read it, right?
Right. And on the note of creating self-awareness, why is it important to do that and look just not at ourselves and the physiological impacts and journeys our bodies go on along with the stressors of life today, but also creating common language and understanding to let other people know I support you or I hear you, or especially in the workplace now, as we are here doing a Zoom call, everyone's doing Zoom day to day. How do we establish that language and that kind of culture and new safe space to acknowledge the things that we would maybe be reticent to talk about in the past?
Yeah, and I'm so hopeful that we're at a tipping point and leaders see that they are leading with a big blind spot. And it's not even on our radar screen that we've got this huge blind spot. So as you acknowledge, pre-COVID, we all lived these lives where the fuller it seemed our to-do list was, or the longer our to-do list was, it gave us a sense of importance, right? Like, I'm so busy. Now you layer COVID on top of all that. And now we are in the space where people are significantly challenged and it's affecting their ability to perform and be a team member. And it's not on the radar screen of leaders that their people are going through this. And I don't believe for a second that that's the denial. I just think they lack awareness, right? Leaders have not had to manage mental and emotional health. And so what the program does is, without having to understand the particulars of each employee's or person's situation, this session allows you to have a little bit of insight into the mental and emotional stability of your team on a daily basis. And then you lead to where they are, not lead to get things checked off your list. Because if you're a leader today, if you thought you were busy before, they're busier now, right? Because of everything that's happened. But what's getting lost in the shuffle here is our humanity. And so my goal with this content is to help us not just eke ourselves out to the other side of it, but to thrive along the way, right? There's certain things we can't control. Look, I can't control that my name's plastered all over this city, right? I can't control that people reach out to me and ask me crazy questions about my husband or the restaurant or why this is happening and why that isn't happening. I can't control any of that. The only thing that I can control is myself. And I want to be able to be in a space where I am receptive and responsive as opposed to reactive. And when we are firing on as many cylinders as we are right now, collectively, globally, it's very difficult to perform well in a way that you're proud of when you're firing on all cylinders in an age of extreme uncertainty. We don't like change. So what can we do? What we can do is ourselves.
You know, a lot of people have brought up the example of, you know, put on your own oxygen mask before assisting others. So what tools do you recommend to help us self-regulate?
So I think the first thing is to have a better understanding of when, so it's a clinical term. It's called the window of tolerance. And what the window of tolerance means is that on any given day, we are all bound by this window of tolerance. We have the ability to tolerate life until a certain point, and then something happens and it gets us outside of this window of tolerance. And that's when our behavior starts to become incongruent and confusing. And so the idea is, what can we do to stay inside that window in a self-preservation, call it self-care if you will, but I see it more as preservation right now, mode. The first is to recognize when it's getting prickly and to own that, right? If you didn't get a good night's sleep because it just happened within my own family, a little bit of an extension of my family. But yesterday, a family member found out that her kid's school was closed and they were going to have to put both girls back at home in virtual learning. She's a nurse. She does at-home care. Her husband's an attorney. And her life just changed on a dime, right? So if we don't have the awareness of what's happening to us as it's happening, our brain takes over and it literally creates this narrative that gets bigger every time it tells us the story. And so now life's really prickly, right? So I think the first step is to own it and just say, hey, self, it's a little prickly here this morning. I need to watch out. What can I do to make myself feel better about my circumstances at this moment in time? And it's simple things, and they can find traces of this all the way back to Aristotle. So the things that we've all been told that we don't do: exercise, sleep, spend time outside, be careful of what you're putting into your mouth to nourish and sustain your body. And then it's so important, as hard as it is to do this, but to stay connected to people. We are hardwired in our DNA to be connected to other people. And when we deny that, we suffer. It is the antithesis of self-preservation. I've been engaging in longer conversations on the phone with my family. I was on the phone with my brother for an hour and a half the other night. I don't think we've ever done that. But he lives in Florida. I'm not going to get to see him for Christmas. And we had the nicest conversation, you know, like I was 100% focused on him and us and that conversation in the moment. And it's so important to stay connected to people right now.
Another thing this can lead into is that we shouldn't assume our relationships, right? We should take the effort to check in, whether it's family, friends, or would you also say, you know, in the workplace, if you are in charge of a team, to be more attuned.
Yep. Life is happening so quickly right now, and so many things have happened since March that have the potential to have caused trauma for people, where they are more easily triggered by things. And people have a way of hiding it. It's easier to hide anxiety on a Zoom than in a meeting. And I think it's really important to just start it off by saying, hey, how are you today? I've had several of those instances where the answer was, I'm struggling. And then that completely shifts the conversation, right? If somebody's struggling, do you honestly think that whatever it is that you need from them is of importance? What's more important at that moment is to see the humanity in them. You know, when I reflect on my own life, the things that mean the most to me are the things I worked the hardest for or had to wait the longest for. And so in so many ways, I've found my own silver linings in this last 8 months, because it's reminded me of some of the joys of life. Running through leaves. Every Tuesday, I get to be the babysitter for my 3-year-old nephew. And I said, come on, Harry, we're going to go walk through the leaves. And he looked at me like I was kind of crazy. And as soon as I started, he got it. And then he would just run back and forth through the leaves. And I mean, the joy, I can't even remember the last time I said, I'm going to go run through the leaves. And it brought me back to my childhood and such great memories of fall and why I love being a Midwesterner. So I think another thing is to just focus on those little things that bring you joy. I also think another thing that people can think about, and you know, God bless Oprah for starting it. I don't know how many years ago, she probably wasn't even the one that started it, but she gets the credit. Having a regular gratitude practice and focusing on what you have as opposed to what you don't have, right? When we come from a place of deficit and we focus on the things that we have no longer, I no longer have a husband. I no longer am associated with the company that I gave my life to for 18 years. If I focus on those things, then what happens is my heart starts to crystallize around the lack, as opposed to being grateful that I had an incredible husband. My God, the love of my life. How lucky. Most people never know the kind of love that I did. How awesome that I got to stand by his side for 18 years and help him and support him and watch him build what he did, right? And so I think that if we can find a way, no matter how dark it is, to see it from a place of gratitude as opposed to a place of deficit, it's certainly something that helps me.
Well, and I think perhaps what we should leave it on is that, you know, even though this workshop is part of the Women's Entrepreneurship Week, and in a time where pre-COVID, perhaps participants would be thinking about how can I be more successful in my endeavors. But when it comes to effectively just connecting with ourselves and others, that should be our priority and not necessarily the bottom line of what we're trying to juggle.
Yeah, I'm 100% there. And it makes me think back to my husband. You know, when he began building the company, much to everybody else's utter shock and dismay, Joe never did it for the money. Joe was never in it for the bottom line. And, you know, I think a testament to how he lived his life and to that fact about connecting with other people and taking care of ourselves. I mean, 2,300 people showed up at his celebration of life at the Riverside Theater. You don't get there by having been anybody but the guy that he was, right? The guy that always had time for somebody else and did a pretty good job of self-preservation and self-care best he could with himself.
Well, Jennifer Bartolotta, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your insights with us today. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Audrey. All my best to you, and go do some self-preservation today.
Jennifer Bartolotta is the founder of Bartolotta and Associates. She's presenting a workshop called U101 on November 18th as part of Women's Entrepreneurship Week in Milwaukee, which starts tomorrow. We'll take one more break, then hear part of the latest Listen MKE, which looks at the importance of mentorship. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM has been partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE, the latest event focused on the need for good mentorship for young Black and Brown people here in Milwaukee. The conversation was hosted by James Causey from the Journal Sentinel and took place last Thursday on Facebook Live. The event included a number of speakers from Milwaukee and Nashville. We hear first from Michael Pratt, founder of Fatherhood Fridays. He begins by explaining what the program is and how it's impacted the lives of young people.
Fatherhood Friday started when I was assistant principal at John Early School, and John Early in Nashville was located in 37208 zip code, and that zip code had the highest rate of African-American male incarceration in the nation at one point. So when I came to the school, I looked around. We had over 60 fights in 2 months, and it was pretty rough. But I looked around and I said, what's missing? And the thing that I saw was missing was men. So I just came up with some strategies of how we can get engaged men to in the school, and came with the program Fatherhood Friday, where we would have breakfast in the morning with men. Men would come in and have breakfast with kids. And we'd also have a piece where we would display something from the community, and we have a community circle. And the idea of it is that, you know, kids will be what they see. So in that community, if you see people selling dope, then that's what you're going to do. And more importantly, and more specifically, kids will be what they see men doing confidently. So, you know, if we're very confident in our athletic ability, then, you know, we're going to have a lot of athletes. If we're very confident in our rap, then we're going to have a lot of rappers. So we need to, you know, the idea is to create something where children can see men being confident in literacy, you know, reading with literacy. So that's what the program was about and is about. And we did it at John Early, I'm involved in a lot of different organizations. I began to call some of the people from my organizations, and I like to say that the mottos of organization or the principles are the smelling salts. So if I'm a member of Phi Beta Sigma, I just say, hey, you know, we stand for Brotherhood, Scholarship, and Service. So that's what we're supposed to do. And I called the fraternity, and they came out. I called other fraternities and various groups of men, and they came out. It was 30, 40 men coming to read with kids. So it was really phenomenal. You know, at one point, we had 66 men come in at 7:45 to 8:15 to come in and read to kids. And you know, at the beginning of it, I asked kids, how many of y'all have been in a room with a man with two men reading? And nobody raises their hand. How many have been in a room with one man reading? And most kids don't see their parents reading, you know, so they're going to be, you know, what they see, and they need to see men reading. And when we put those books out and those men pick up the books, the kids stare at them, then the kids pick up the books. And we could see that we were not just creating kids who were able to analyze text for tests, but we were creating lifelong readers, lifelong learners, people who enjoy kids who enjoy books like they enjoy PS5 or something like that.
Well, that's important is, you know, the men get something out of this, too, as well, the mentors.
When you mentor, a lot of times when I ask someone, a friend, I say, hey, won't you come to Fatherhood Fridays? The first question is really they're asking, what do you need me to do? You know, and I got a lot on my plate and those things. So I tried my best to design it in a way where it was friendly to men, where you come in, you eat, and you sit down and read, and then you connect with kids, and it's easy, you know. And that's the thing is that I think we believe sometimes as men, we have to be perfect to be a mentor. And when I first was asked to mentor, I was like, I don't know if you want me to mentor. I'm not ready yet. But, you know, you can teach someone what to do or teach them what not to do. So everyone could be a mentor, and we have to create, Father Friday creates a venue where men can be successful mentoring. And once they do it, they get hooked, you know, and once they engage those kids and become confident in what they bring to the table, they hooked, you know, when they say, what should I wear? Should I wear a tie? I say, where would you go wear to work? You know, where if you take off, then where would you? But they need to see all kinds of men who were formerly incarcerated, men who are CEOs of companies, all different types of men. And they need to see those men reading.
Let's bring on Myra Taylor. I want to find out from her, how has that changed the impact on your school, especially with the young boys in your school?
First of all, one way to quantify our success, saw an increase in library circulation after a few Fatherhood Fridays. The first one, not so much, but after the students got used to it, they knew it was coming. They would ask, hey, when are we doing that thing with the people again, which was Fatherhood Friday. We saw an increase in the circulation in the library. Our kiddos wanted the books in their hands. They wanted to read. They wanted to engage with texts that were on their level that they could read and take home and bring back and get new books. So we absolutely saw an increase in students' interest in reading, not necessarily their reading levels, but their interest in engaging with the text.
So can you explain a little bit about where Buena Vista is located? It's in a really rough zip code. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Unfortunately, Buena Vista is no longer. Our district consolidated that school with another school that's less than a mile away. It's directly across the street from government housing, which, you know, we had students from all from a wide range. We had students who walked to school from across the street. We also had parents who drove their kids to our school because they knew their students would get all of the supports they needed. But just to give you a quick idea, I had one student, a girl, who at our second, I believe it was our second Fatherhood Friday, asked me, Miss Taylor, can I still participate? My daddy's dead. Her father had been killed a few years before. And I was like, of course, you can be a part of this. We want you here. We will have someone here that can read with you. Our bus driver, who was a man, came every time. And there were a few students who waited for him. They would wait for our bus driver to come because he was their mentor. It meant a lot to our kiddos to have those men come in, eat with them, sit with them, and read a real book with them. It's been huge. Like I said, Buena Vista is no longer a school per se, but our students are still here. We've consolidated with another school, but our students still have those needs. We had a mentor come in from the state to meet with our fourth grade boys, just the fourth grade boys. And he asked them, how many of you have a parent who is incarcerated? Every child but one. So we're talking about 42 kids raised their hands. So that just gives you an idea of the community in which we serve.
And Mr. Pratt, I guess the same question goes for you. How do you quantify the success of the Fatherhood Friday program where you are?
I think one of the main ways is just inspiring men to mentor. So it got to the point where people wanted to have it. We would have it once a month or once every 2 weeks. People wanted to have it every Friday. And the other one aspect of the Fatherhood Friday is not just the kids, but empowering men to be mentors. So I began to see a lot more activity from the organizations and other people, from those men and a lot of other mentoring organizations. So I think that's one of the keys is to, to inspire men to reconnect back to their communities, and not just men, but inspire organizations. So that was one of the main things that I saw that I was really impressed with, that, was constantly, men asking me, hey, are we going to do a Fatherhood Friday this weekend? And in the beginning, I would have to, take time personally to just talk to someone to convince them to mentor. But it was, it was references. It were whole groups of people showing up who I hadn't talked to, or, it was just. So I think that's it. It's just creating a movement of men being engaged in the community. That's one of the main ways I quantify it.
So what are these children? I'm going to ask this and then I'll shut up for a second. But I do want to know what are these children, and in a lot of these cases, you mentioned some of these mentors too. What are the students and what are the mentors getting from these fatherhood initiatives? What are they learning? What are they talking about? Just the subject matters, and what do they walk away with?
So I just want to say, I know from doing this for 20 plus years, that the primary thing that our students, the low socioeconomic background lack, is exposure. And this was all about exposure. It was exposing our students to a different type of environment. Our kids were exposed to professionals. They were exposed to blue collar workers. They were exposed to a variety of texts, whether it was fiction or nonfiction. And they were exposed to people, adults, men who sat with them and read a text and had a discussion about that. So what our kids got was the exposure. It opened up doors. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but it's the truth. You have a child who has never sat with an adult other than a teacher in a school to read a book. And most of their teachers are not Black men. So they would sit with the teacher and read a book. Now they have a man, an adult, who comes in and reads a book and talks to them about the book and asks them, what do you want to be as an adult? How do you see your future? That gives our students a totally different lens. They took away being exposed to something different, and it sparked imagination, I would say. It sparked their imagination. It sparked their desire to do and be and see something different than what they've always been.
Yeah, that's it. And I think sometimes it's easy to quantify test scores and things, or, but the reality is relationships, at our core and primary. So developing those relationships and those men coming back to that school, many of them participated even in between and after Fatherhood Friday. So that's the key, just to ignite that fire under the men and under those organizations, and to raise expectations for kids. When a young lady sits in a room with 60 men, a second grader, and she sees men reading, then she expects the man later on that she meets to read. And when boys see other men reading, they read. And I think I remember there was one instance where two boys came up to one of the readers and said, hey, I can do push-ups. I can do these push-ups. But that's the way these boys thought to impress a man, is that let me show you how many push-ups I can do. It has to always be physical. So just changing that mindset through Fatherhood Friday is really a mindset thing.
Yeah, which brings up relationships. And I want to bring on John Daniels III to talk about the relationships that that were developed between mentors and students over the summer through his MKE Fellows and Fellows program. John, talk a little bit about the MKE Fellows and working with the school over the summer.
Sure. Thanks so much. We're really excited this year to be able to work with students at a few schools in the city of Milwaukee. I run the MKE Fellows Program, and it's composed of college-age students. And the number of middle school students who had never met someone who looked like them in college was just mind-blowing to me. I think the statistic I heard the other day is that in America, 83% of elementary educators are Caucasian females, and that only 7% are African-American, and of that 7%, only 2% are male. And so to have these young college students who are close to their age, being able to talk to them about math and reading, it really was amazing, even hearing some of the things that they discussed about their majors and topics that interest them.
So what school did you work with over the summer?
So we were both at Metcalf, and then we were on Holy Redeemer's campus as well. And that gave us an opportunity to deal with a variety of middle school students who had a variety of areas of experience. At Metcalf, we had students in that zip code who had students who went to Marquette, college students who went to Marquette, and they had had similar experiences. And having them have the opportunity to talk about, oh, yes, I went to this school, or I remember riding the 12, or whatever it was, gave them an opportunity to build a relationship, to not just talk about the fundamentals of education, but also to build a relationship of similarities and hear about how they, too, could succeed in their career.
Yeah. One thing that I noticed that, you know, when I observed how the MKE fellows were working with the students was just a simple relationship. The young people really wanted to impress these fellows. I mean, they really wanted to impress them. So they read, they talked, they considered them like big brothers. And that was a very unique feeling. And I just think that's inspiring. And can you talk a little bit about what the MKE fellows and how that whole relationship started with them in the school in the first place? Because normally they would be offered internships to do other things.
Yeah, so this year has been a year of challenges for almost all of us. And one of the things we noticed in the springtime is that the reading levels of students was struggling through virtual education. And so we set up a partnership first with Metcalf School to have some of our college students, our MKE fellows are there's about 200 young men from the Milwaukee area who go to about 30 different colleges across America. We wanted to partner them with these middle school students. In a normal year, our internships are at Baird and Advocate Aurora and Northwestern Mutual and companies working in finance and engineering and at GE. But because of the nature of being virtual for safety, we created a program that we called the Five Pillars that really helped the young people to know that it wasn't just a college student that was investing time in their education, but there were strong pillars of the community that were standing behind them. And they had this support system behind them as they, too, continued to work on their education. And so we hired the college students to do this throughout the year.
This is a good time to bring on Linnell Ramey, Executive Director of Mentor Greater Milwaukee. Let's talk about what you do at Mentor Greater Milwaukee.
Absolutely. A lot of times, and even Brother Pratt alluded to it earlier, it's like people get confused on what a mentor is, but it's really about that support system, right? It's really being a leverage for a young person to allow them to navigate life's issues and potentially see something in themselves or get something brought out of them that traditionally hasn't been seen or talked about. So some of the things and advantages of mentors does is we know for a fact that young people who have a mentor in their life are 37% less likely than their peer to do something like skip school. They're 50% less likely than their peer to skip an entire day of school. You know, so, you know, when we start to see things like that happen with a young person in school, it starts to transform the thinking that a young person will have in school. Everything from their ethnic and racial identity, for example, when you put a Black man, a man of color in front of a student, it starts to build their confidence in who they are as a Black man. And I wanted to say something, because Brother Pratt alluded to this a little bit earlier, regarding about data, for example, because sometimes we start a mentoring program like they did at the school, and then people want to see reading numbers increase that same year. What took years to tear down takes years to rebuild up. So we need to have the opportunity to allow mentorship to be a part of that process. When you start to put men of color in front of students, and I love what you said about men of all backgrounds, because everybody has a story. It's how you tell that story which makes you an effective mentor, right? So if you want to only tell your war stories about what you did when you was on the block and that's all you're speaking to, then you're going to keep that young man's mind boxed in the block that you're talking to. But when you can expand their thinking and show how you made it out, and you from the same neighborhood and you went to the same school, I went to the best high school there is, Riverside University High School here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I stand on that, right? But when you show that type of love, and to your point, Earl, right, because you're going to stand on Marshall, right? You're going to stand
all
on
day,
that school. But when you start to show the love and passion that you have about your experiences, that's what mentorship is about. Then our young Black boys start to see that, and they see a different Black man than what they're being told about who they are. Because many times my young brothers only see what's in their kind of two block radius, and therefore that's what they think they're supposed to become. But we get to tear down that myth through mentorship. We get to remove those barriers through mentorship by being allies for our young people and speaking up for our young people and allowing them to see a different them as well.
Linnell Ramey is the executive director of Mentor Greater Milwaukee. You also heard from John Daniels, the executive director of the MKE Fellows Program, Myra Taylor, the principal of Buena Vista Elementary School in Nashville, and Michael Pratt, the founder of Fatherhood Fridays in Nashville. They spoke with James Causey from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as part of Listen MKE. The conversation was recorded last Thursday on Facebook Live. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. You can find the full conversation at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.